I thought we'd chat about Iran.
Great.
A lot to talk about.
There is a lot to talk about.
Let's talk about you first and the Just Foreign Policy group that you are the policy director. Tell me about your group.
We're a non-profit, non-partisan group that works to promote U.S. foreign policy that reflects the values and interests of the majority of Americans, in particular ending present wars and trying to prevent new ones, trying to bring the U.S. into compliance with international law and move the U.S. away from use of force and threat of force in its international relations. We do that by educating our members, people on our list, about what the U.S. is doing, what's going on in the world, doing action alerts directed at policymakers and the media, and writing about these issues in places like Huffington Post, Truth Out, Common Dreams, and Al Jazeera.
Mm. Well, that's quite a broad scope.
Well, there is a lot to do, and we can't even, you know, claim that we're scratching the surface of everything wrong with U.S. foreign policy, but we're particularly focused on U.S. policy in the Middle East, because that's where a lot of the problems are, you know. To declared wars, many undeclared wars, and also arguably the place of most grievous action, greatest need, and also it's a place where most of the Americans are who are aware of something, that's what they're aware of and concerned about. So it's a place where there's potential for change. Well, we've seen, for example, you look at the turnaround that's happened since 2005, 2006 in U.S. policy in Iraq. The Pentagon was determined to keep troops there, and it has failed as a result of opposition to its plans, not only in the United States, but of course also in Iraq and elsewhere.
Right.
So I think this shows the kind of turnaround that's possible. It didn't happen as fast as many people would have liked, and you know, a tremendous amount of suffering happened in the meantime. So obviously we can't be too, you know, there's a cloud on our joy.
Right.
But nonetheless, you know, we achieved the result. And hopefully this will set a precedent and we can achieve other results more quickly with less loss of life. And we're currently trying to achieve the same results in Afghanistan, the full withdrawal of U.S. troops, and we can see, you know, there's some developments that we can point to as steps on the path to bringing that about. You know, there's some kind of timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops, certainly not a firm timetable. There are first steps towards negotiations with the Afghan Taliban. This is the direction in which we need more pressure and more movement.
Do you actually sit down with politicians? Obviously you're non-partisan, but do you discuss with them, bring them information? How do you work with them?
Well, we interact with congressional offices, mainly of our allies. But mostly what we try to do is get Americans to contact their representatives, because that's what they listen to, is, you know, actually care a lot about, you know, what is it that people care about. So, for example, you know, they're clearly hearing a lot from people about the war in Afghanistan and wanting the war to end. So we want more of that. And they're starting to hear from people that they're concerned about or opposed to the potential for military escalation with Iran. And that's something that we're trying to increase as well. So this is mainly how we try to have influence, is by trying to get more Americans mobilized to contact their representatives, although we do some small amount of direct contact ourselves. You know, we have a long history in the United States of leading Republicans seeing, quote-unquote, strong military as sort of a core plank of the platform. And we attack Democrats on a strong military, and also in terms of policy, you know, we have a kind of military Keynesianism, where Republicans say that they're for small government, except when it comes to the military, where they're for huge government.
Right.
And now military spending is the majority of federal discretionary spending. So that's a long-standing pattern. And there, you're right, you know, they're just, on the political side, they're just looking to attack President Obama as weak on national defense in some way. They can't really attack him on terrorism very much because they got Osama bin Laden, although they try. And they can't attack him on the Iraq withdrawal very much because the majority of Americans overwhelmingly support the Iraq withdrawal, including the majority of Republicans. Mm. Although they have, with the exception of Ron Paul, tried to attack him on that as well, which I think shows that on these issues, the majority of them, not Ron Paul, are really appealing not to voters. Because clearly voters, even in Republican primaries and caucuses, don't want that agenda. But they're appealing to another constituency in the Republican Party, which is the you know, the military wing, the neoconservative think tanks, Heritage Foundation, American Enterprise Institute, and moneyed interests that
exactly.
want to maintain high military spending and a policy of military confrontation.
Right.
On Iran, they're all pushing military escalation, except for Ron Paul. So, again, there's at least some debate there, which is, again, a turnaround.
Yeah, it's an ugly cycle we keep seeing, isn't it?
Yes, although, again, there seems to be a little bit of a break, suggesting that something else could happen. I mean, it's particularly interesting if you look at the demographics of Ron Paul's support. If you look at the entrance polling in Iowa and New Hampshire, you got something like half of the youth vote and half of the independent vote. And you even have Senator DeMint, apparently, in South Carolina. You know, DeMint is kind of a leading figure in the Tea Party wing, recently said Republicans shouldn't trash Ron Paul because we need the energy that people that are supporting. Well, again, if you look at the demographics, it's young. You know, you look at the median age of Republicans, it's old.
Yeah.
You look at who the young Republicans are supporting, the young Republicans are trending to Ron Paul. That suggests that there is a potential movement, even among Republicans, on questions of the empire and civil liberties. Which obviously are related because it's in the context of this, you know, permanent war that these restrictions on civil liberties like the Patriot Act have been justified.
Interesting, talking about Ron Paul, obviously he's had a lot of flack about some of his past or writings under his name. So you throw that into the Mideast, you would have quite a little stew going on there, I think. I don't think the Jewish vote or Israel would be too happy with him.
Speaking as a Jewish person myself, I have to say I'm totally delighted with it. But I think the broader point is that there is clearly a constituency that, which again is an older demographic. I mean, if you talk to young Jews, they're not all of them, but a lot of them, they're totally fed up with Israel. They're totally fed up with Israeli policy.
Yeah.
They're totally fed up with U.S. policy. They're totally alienated from you. Look at the full data. I mean, Jewish organizations do polling on this, and there's a huge age split between older Jews in the United States and younger Jews in the United States, with younger Jews not identifying with Israel, not identifying with Israeli policy. So you're right that, I mean, there is a powerful constituency, not necessarily in terms of absolute numbers, but, you know, just like, you know, the gun lobby or the anti-abortion lobby or the Cuba lobby,
yeah.
There is this old guard of passionate, engaged, you know, highly motivated and well-financed people that support a very militarist policy. It's really pro-Likud policy, not a pro-Israel policy. It
right.
doesn't reflect the majority of Jews in the United States by any means, but, you know, that's not, till now, that's not how things are determined. You look at the full data, American Jews are quite dovish, but overall, but that's not, you know, that's not what people in Washington are generally paying attention to. They're not looking They're not asking themselves, what do American Jews think about this? They're asking themselves, what does the American Israel Public Affairs Committee think? That's what's mobilized. That's what's, you know, giving money to campaigns, not them directly, but, you know, they sort of make clear to people that do give money who they're supposed to give money to. So that, I think are all important distinctions for understanding the world. It's not really Jews per se, it's a particular group. Support a very militaristic policy and that do not, you know, were never elected by American Jews at all. And I think these trends are increasing. I think it's wonderful. I mean, alienation isn't wonderful, but some subset of the people who become alienated from these policies have become active in opposing these policies. So, for example, in early March, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee is having its annual policy conference in Washington. Well, for the last couple years, there's been a sort of protest mobilization, which is now called Occupy AIPAC. You know, friends with some of these people that are organizing this, and they're all Jews.
Oh, no.
All the people that I know that are organizing, they're all Jews. So I think this, you know, we know what the overall balance of forces are. Like, you know, the anti-AIPAC Jews are not about to defeat the AIPAC Jews politically anytime soon. But again, the fact that there's even, you know, kind of public dispute that people can see that there's two sides, that are just one side, is already a huge step forward in human history.
Perhaps you can give a little, maybe, history of basically our recent history with Iran in terms of, obviously, everything changed when the Shah was deposed with the Iranian Revolution in, 79. How did things change to get to where we are today?
Well, first of all, let's take one small step back, because I think that the right place to start U.S. history with Iran is not 1979, but 1953.
Oh,
because that's when the United States and Britain conspired to overthrow the democratically elected Iranian government under Mohammad Mossadegh. And what was the casus belli? It was the fact that this democratically elected government in Iran nationalized Iran's oil, which was previously controlled by the British under a sweetheart concession that was a legacy of British colonialism in Iran. That is context which many Americans don't know. Some Americans do know it. Many Americans don't know it, but everybody in Iran knows it.
Yeah.
And it forms a backdrop of everything that's happening today. So, for example, the United States and Britain are currently pursuing an oil embargo against Iran. Well, that's a tactic that the United States and Britain used against Iran in the early 1950s prior to the coup.
Mm.
So when people in Iran see the attempts at embargo in the context of threats of regime change, that's something that's informed by their sense of history. It's also informed by, you know, the statements of officials in the U.S. and Britain and other places that clearly want to overthrow the Iranian government. But even if that weren't true, people see it in historical context, that there's a long-term U.S., British, French, but mainly U.S. and British, policy of trying to overthrow nationalist governments in Iran and replace them with governments that will do the bidding of the West, which is what they did in 1953, overthrew a democratically elected nationalist government in Iran, replaced it with the government of the Shah, which remained in power until it was overthrown in 1978 by popular uprising. So, and that brought about the government that exists today, and the, you know, you ask why that government is anti-American. Well, one reason is that its legacy of a revolution that was a revolution against the United States and Britain, in addition to being, you know, it was a revolution against the Shah, but the Shah was perceived as a puppet of the United States and Britain that had been imposed on Iran by the United States and Britain. And I think that's important context for Americans to understand.
Yes.
You know, trying, because, oh, you know, a key question that we should always ask ourselves is, well, how does this look from the other guy's point of view? So, you know, how does U.S. policy look from the point of view of Iranians? Of course, you know, all Iranians don't see everything the same, just like all Americans don't see everything the same. But on this question of, you know, understanding U.S. policy in its historical context, there is a broad spectrum of Iranian opinion that sees the U.S. policy as part of historical effort to keep Iran down, to attack governments in Iran that are, you know, pursuing national objectives and replace them with governments that will do the bidding of the West.
Not much has changed then in nearly 60 years, in other words.
Well, but one thing that's changed is that there's less tolerance in the world. I think there is progress in human history, at least in the sense of, with respect to this, that there's much less tolerance in the world for colonialism or colonialist-like policies or imperialist-like policies than there was in 1953. If you look at the, and partly because the distribution of power in the world has changed, and partly because, you know, if you look at the composition of the United Nations, for example, in 1953, and you look at it today, there's a lot more countries in the United Nations today, countries that were colonies of the colonial powers in 1953. Well, you know, you talk to people in those countries, you talk to their governments, their leading intellectuals, they have, again, it's not all the same, but there's a trend that you can see, and it's a trend to see these issues in anti-colonialist terms. So, for example, when the United States and Britain and France wanted to intervene militarily in Libya, there was a lot of resistance to that in the United Nations. Okay, they got there. Eventually, they got their way. But it was a struggle. And now that there are calls for the United States, Britain, and France to intervene militarily in Syria, there's a lot of resistance to that in the United Nations. In part because of what happened in Libya, where people felt like they were rolled. You know, it was a trick. You said this was a no-fly zone to protect civilians, but really what it was a military intervention for regime change. And a lot of people in the world see the confrontation with Iran in exactly the same light. Okay, you have a dispute with Iran about its nuclear program. You have these other disputes with Iran. But really, this is about a goal that the U.S., Britain, and France have for regime change in Iran, you know, another oil producer in the Middle East where the U.S. has a long-term goal of overthrowing a government that's perceived to be hostile to its interests and trying to replace with a government perceived to be friendly to its interests.
Back in the Carter years, quite possibly Iran was the cause of Jimmy Carter losing against Reagan with the October surprise and the hostages not being released. We've got a history there, politically.
Well, indeed. I'm agnostic on the October surprise thing. I respect who have access to good information are on both sides of this issue. The claim that the people connected with the Reagan campaign had intervened to try to block the hostages' release. I don't know whether that's true. There's some evidence for it, and so I'm officially agnostic on that.
Okay.
But the larger point is clearly true. I remember it from the time. You know, there were a lot of reasons that a lot of people were upset with Jimmy Carter, but one of them was the fact that he had failed to free the hostages. And, of course, you know, part of the fact that there was a crisis in the first place was his fault. He backed Shah till almost the end. Then he switched and started, you know, when it was clear that, just as we saw today, we see the same pattern today, where the U.S. backed Mubarak, not quite till the end,
pretty close.
To the point where, you know, more enlightened forces said, wow, the game is up, we need to switch horses.
Right.
And then they said, hey, you know, we're concerned about human rights in Egypt. Well, the Carter administration did the same thing. You know, it was very pro-Shah, until, you know, there was mass demonstrations in Iran, and to which the Shah's government basically responded with repression, and then the Carter administration started to talk about human rights. But it was slow to make that switch, and it was slow to deal with the revolution and try to accommodate the new government. And in particular, it made the very controversial decision to allow the Shah to come to the United States against the strong advice of people in the U.S. Embassy in Iran, who said, you know, you can't do this. This is going to be interpreted in Iran as in the worst possible light if you allow the Shah to come to the United States, as indeed it was. And we've seen, largely seen in Iran, as proof that the U.S. is still trying to control Iran and overthrow our government. And so it had the worst possible consequences, not just in terms of the hostage crisis, which, of course, was horrible for those people that were captive, but also in helping to determine the course which things took, which they could, you know, there was a revolutionary government that represented a broad cross-section of forces, not just the Khomeinis, but the hostage crisis and the escalation the confrontation helped the most hardline forces and marginalized the more moderate forces and helped produce the government that we saw afterwards. So that really was a terrible U.S. foreign policy failure from the point of view of, you know, those who think that the United States should try to accommodate the popular aspirations in the region, which the Obama administration is, to a certain extent, trying to do today in the context of the Arab Spring. It's trying to take steps towards accommodating popular aspirations and not having, you know, the kind of total finger-in-the-dike approach that has led to disaster so many times in the past.
Yeah, that was one of the most amusing things, I think, watching Hillary Clinton squirm as things changed by the day, as she somehow had to reposition all the time. It was very interesting during that process.
It was interesting, but I just have to say, you know, consider the alternative.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a period of, there was a week where it seemed like, read the newspaper every morning to find out what U.S. policy is, because it's going to be different than the way that it was done before. But on the other hand, what's the alternative?
Right.
And the alternative is policy staying the same,
right,
and it should change. And, you know, so, and the change was positive. So the old policy, I mean, it threw the contrast into stark relief, because after all, the previous policy was supporting a dictatorship in Egypt for 30 years,
right,
and turning a deaf ear to the cries, yeah, of the Egyptian people. So the process of changing from that policy to at least, you know, and it hasn't been a 180-degree change by any means, but at least the idea that the U.S. has to care what the majority of Egyptians think, and that should be a significant element,
yep,
in forming U.S. policy, that was a real change. You know, that change, yep, happened over the course of a week. And it looked funny at the time, but it's a great improvement in U.S. policy.
Think that a few uploads, you know, on YouTube from Tahrir Square can change a government's policy? That's pretty heady stuff.
Well, it is, and I think there's a really important lesson there, which it shows, in a sense, how fragile U.S. policy is, in the sense that it can't stand sustained public scrutiny.
Mm.
You know, what happened in Egypt was, remember, the U.S. press largely missed the uprising in Tunisia. They got some criticism for that.
Right.
Then when things started to get serious in Egypt, they said, okay, you know, we're not going to miss this one. And the U.S. media was there in full force. Of course, it's Egypt, not Tunisia. Everybody understood that, you know, Egypt is more important. It's historically a fulcrum in the region.
Right.
So all these events that happened in Tahrir Square and elsewhere in Egypt were fully covered by the U.S. media. CNN was there, the networks were there, the New York Times was there. And that meant that the crackdown on peaceful protesters happened on American TV screens. Americans that never paying attention before to U.S. policy in the Middle East, you know, we're suddenly seeing like freedom versus repression.
Right.
Freedom, you know, human beings, you know, before the only, like, Egypt was Mubarak and the pyramids and peace treaty with Israel. And all of a sudden you have human beings demanding their freedom. People just like you, just want to be free. And America is empathized with that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like ordinary human beings versus a dictatorship. Americans are on the side of the ordinary human beings. There's no way you could sustain the policy of Mubarak is our friend because he's friends with Israel. And any friend of Israel is a friend of ours. There's no way you could sustain that in the context of those images on American TV screens every night, night after night. So that's an important lesson for everybody to always keep in mind. These policies can only be sustained because they're not being put in front of the American people every day. And any time we can put this in front of the American people every day, then, you know, these policies can break down.
Very exhilarating when you think of it, just that, you know, that type of explosion in media access like that. Wow, I mean, it's changed the world instantly.
Yes, and it shows that there is a path to significant fundamental reform of U.S. policy in the Middle East if these efforts are sustained.
Iran, I think most people don't really know politically how it operates. We know Ahmadinejad, he's a sort of prime minister, but then there's all the shadowy mullahs, and it doesn't make a lot of sense for us, I think. How does it work? I know there are elections per se. How does that all work from the top to bottom?
Well, it is complicated. Like any government is complicated. It's not so easy sometimes for people outside the United States to understand our political process. You know, I remember I was in Washington during the 2000 election, and I was being interviewed on the BBC. The British were completely mystified. They had no idea what was going on, as many Americans were mystified. So, yeah, it's not always easy to understand a completely different political process. And the political process in Iran is complicated. There are these different sources of power. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is the president, the elected president of Iran, but he's not the most powerful official in the country under the Iranian constitution. The most powerful official is the supreme leader, who's currently Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and he's not directly elected by the people, but elected by a council of religious leaders. So there are two centers, at least, and then they also have an elected parliament, they have other bodies. So there are different centers of power around, just like there are different centers of power in the United States, even in the elected government. We have the president, we have the House and the Senate, we have the Supreme Court, and there are, and then there's Federal Reserve, there are different centers of power.
Right.
In the case of Iran, the supreme leader has ultimate authority over foreign and military policy. So that means, for example, that if President Ahmadinejad wants to negotiate with the United States over Iran's nuclear program, he doesn't have the final say. Mm. He has a significant influence, but he doesn't have the final say.
Interesting. Does he mainly do internal? Is that really his job, more of an internal?
Well,
he has more power.
The president's power in Iran is his formal power. You know, where he has exclusive control is more limited to domestic affairs. But clearly, he has some power in the international arena. He has the ability to appoint officials, and he has the bully pulpit. You know, where ordinarily he speaks on behalf of Iran and, you know, international media, and that gives him some ability to influence events. But at the end of the day, he doesn't have final say over foreign and military matters.
Hmm. The religious leaders, how are they picked themselves?
There are a couple of different councils, but in the main, they're elected by other religious leaders. So they represent the democratically elected expression of the clerical establishment.
Do they do any negotiations themselves, or is it always by the parliamentarians?
Well, if you're talking about the external relations, that's conducted by officials of the democratic elected government. So the president picks the foreign minister, subject to approval by parliament. The foreign minister, you know, picks the ambassadors, like it is in the U.S. As I said, with the exception that at the end of the day, the supreme leader, you know, has the final say, and he can't do anything. And so these democratic elected officials can't do anything that the supreme leader doesn't approve of.
Now, obviously, 2 years ago, you can almost point that to maybe be one of the starts of the of what was roiling in the Middle East was the elections in Iran and the riots that ensued. That was quite eye-opening. Does that have any ramifications internally still? How is that playing out?
I think that we don't see much impact of that now. The movement that existed at the time seems to have largely subsided. Conflicts that we see now in the Iranian political system more tend to be between different groups of so-called conservatives. So we have split between the president and the parliament, which is in fact even more quote-unquote conservative than the president on many issues. So, for example, President Ahmadinejad has been more in favor of a diplomatic rapprochement of the United States than some of the hardliners in parliament. Those are the conflicts that have more come to the fore.
Obviously, the nuclear thing has got all the Republican nominees, or prospective ones, saying they're going to bomb Iran if Israel doesn't do it first. What is really happening on the ground in Iran, to the best of your knowledge?
A couple of quick points.
Yes.
The first thing everybody should know is that public opinion polls conducted by Western polling organizations show that the overwhelming majority of Iranians support Iran's nuclear program. Mm. Secondly, all of Iran's declared nuclear sites, are under the inspection of the International Atomic Energy Agency, including this Fordo site that's in the news now. It's under the inspection of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Okay.
So there is no danger that, as long as those inspectors remain, there's no danger that any of this material can be diverted to a military program. No evidence has been shown that there are any secret sites. The U.S. has Iran under heavy surveillance, as indicated recently by the drone that went down. The concern that has been expressed, if you look in the New York Times, about this new site is that, this site would be hard for the United States or Israel to bomb. Well, I mean, if the United States and Israel bombs Iran, that's a grave violation of the United Nations Charter. There's no provision of international law that says Iran has to make its nuclear facilities available for other countries to bomb them. That's not a provision of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So I have to go.
Okay.
And thank you for the interview.
Thank you so much. Good luck.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.